Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. An independent autopsy commissioned by George Floyd's family has been released, and what I'm about to read might be disturbing for some. According to the LA Times, the independent autopsy found George Floyd died of asphyxiation due to neck and back compression. Attorney Ben Crump said the autopsy found Floyd had been healthy, but that the officer's compression cut off the blood supply to his brain. The pressure of other officers' knees on his back made it impossible for him to breathe. Those findings contradict a local autopsy, which noted the effects of being restrained, but also Floyd's underlying health issues and potential intoxicants in his system. It found nothing to support a diagnosis of traumatic asphyxia or strangulation. George Floyd's family and their attorney are calling for the charges against Officer Derek Chauvin to be upgraded from third to first degree murder, and for the three other officers involved to be charged. As the report was released, nationwide protests continue in at least 140 cities across the country, according to the latest analysis from the New York Times. In addition to protests against police brutality in major cities, there are marches and actions happening in places like Bozeman, Montana, Idaho Falls, Belfast, Maine, Berea, Kentucky, and Frisco, Texas. Yesterday in Oakland, 15,000 mostly young people peacefully marched to City Hall. One of today's guests, August Nimes Jr., has been attending anti-police brutality marches for four decades. In a recent piece for the Min Post about last Tuesday's protest in Minneapolis, he writes, "As an African-American of my generation, I still marvel at the racially diverse composition of anti-police brutality protests." The piece is called "It's a Big Deal That the Outrage Expressed Over George Floyd's Death Was Massive and Multiracial," and you can read it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Professor Nimes. Thank you so much for joining us.
How do you do? Thanks for having me.
Good. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Dr. Adnan Ahmed, a community psychiatrist in Minneapolis who's been at the protest over the last week. Dr. Ahmed supports Medicare for All and was part of the group Doctors for Bernie. In December, he wrote a piece for Min Post called "For People of Color, Minnesota Nice is Reminiscent of Racism We Have Experienced." Hi, Dr. Ahmed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, Professor Nimes, I want to start off with you. This autopsy commission report just came out, and I have to say, it's just so hard to read about this without messing up because it is just so brutal. But it's really important to make sure that people are aware of the latest information that is coming out. What are your comments on this?
Yes. No, it was extremely brutal, and we shouldn't be surprised at that autopsy report. The first one, by the way, that came out from here was characterized, at least qualified, as a preliminary one. So perhaps Hennepin County will get its act together now and come out with the facts about what actually took place. So yes, this is what we're looking at the video over and over again. We shouldn't be surprised at this report.
And it is also very sad that the families have to take it upon themselves to commission an autopsy. I mean, most people wouldn't even know where to start, but they have to do this now because, as we're learning, the, quote, official autopsy, this really contradicts the, quote, official autopsy.
Well, it does. And as I said, they are covering themselves with the official one by saying it was a preliminary one. Hmm. But the family is being advised by a lawyer who has a long experience with this. This has been a problem of historically.
Right. And that's Attorney Ben Crump.
Right.
Professor Nimes, you wrote a piece in the Min Post last Tuesday about what you saw on the streets. And again, you have been taking part in these anti-police brutality actions and marches for more than four decades. And you wrote that you still marvel at the racially diverse composition of these protests. That was last week. A lot has changed since then. What have you seen since? What has really stood out for you?
Well, they've become even more diverse. You were listing some of the cities that they're in, and I was just looking at the New York Times map, which is great because it includes actually Fargo. Yes, Fargo, that Fargo, North Dakota. There's a not a whole lot of black people in Fargo, North Dakota. Yes, there was a protest there, also in Duluth, Minnesota, which also doesn't have a whole lot of black people. And so I mention this because this is the breadth of the protests. We've never seen anything like this. And I tend to be a person who thinks about big history and deep history. And a century ago in this country, it was known as a bloody summer, a red summer, when hundreds of African Americans were being lynched all over the country, including Duluth, Minnesota. So it registers how much indeed has changed, despite the ups and downs and the setbacks. And if we understand these changes, we have a better sense about how to go forward.
To your point, when I was looking at this thread on Twitter by someone, Ann Helen Peterson, she said, show me the protests happening in small towns across the country. See, she's actually a writer for BuzzFeed. Professor Nimps, I couldn't even pronounce some of these towns. I've never heard of them. Berea, Kentucky, Frisco, Texas, as you said. And there are so many photos of young white high school kids who have signs say Black Lives Matter, I can't breathe. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
I agree. And it's and that they're peaceful protests. That's important because the news media, because of its big business orientation, likes to grab on to the violence. The violence sells news. And if it leads, it bleeds. it leads is the expression that was oftentimes used. So if you look at the mainstream media, the focus is on the violence. But the fact is that these are largely peaceful mass demonstrations.
Right. Dr. Ahmed, what would you add? What really strikes you about what you are, first off, experiencing on the streets of Minneapolis?
The protests that are happening right now in the streets of Minneapolis are unlike anything that I've ever seen. They are largely multiracial protests. People are joining in solidarity from everywhere. I volunteered as a medic at least on two occasions, the night the third precinct burnt down, and then again on Saturday. And what I saw was the protesters having a lot of solidarity and love for each other. There was sorrow and anger at the institutions, but the protesters were not violent to the extent that I saw towards anybody, towards each other or towards us. I never felt threatened when I was over there. They were thankful. They were nice. They were asking us how we're doing. They were worried about our safety. They were asking us to be safe. And I feel that this police violence and the COVID-19 pandemic has just really been a ripe atmosphere for something like this to come to the surface. Where police violence has been instantly recognizable, and at the same time, it's been it's made it very clear that our institutions and the powers are really designed to protect wealth and not so much the people. Mm. So that is what I saw.
To that point, I wanted to ask you, because I know we have to let you go in about 5 minutes. Health experts are urging police to stop using tear gas on demonstrators. There's an online petition circulating among infectious disease and public health professionals that gas could make the respiratory tract more susceptible to infection. Tear gas especially prompts people to cough and gasp for air. We know that this is being used in Oakland, Walnut Creek, all across the country. What are your thoughts on this, Dr. Ahmed, especially as, you know, it's very hard to physically distance at these protests, especially if you're trying to get away from tear gas?
Absolutely. It is so harmful and dangerous and totally uncalled for to use tear gas on protesters. It makes the COVID-19 people more susceptible to COVID-19 because obviously you're gasping for air, you're trying to run away, your eyes are tearing. I experienced the effects of tear gas the first night that I was out there. And you're really in this very uncomfortable state where you just want to get rid of that stinging, burning sensation in your eyes and your nose. And obviously, if you're gasping for air, you're removing your masks. If you have masks, you're getting in close proximity to each other for help, for people to pour water on you or other relieving agents on top of you. It does break that social distancing barrier, and it creates an atmosphere that is rife to be more susceptible to getting infection.
And we should also say, Dr. Ahmed, at least here in the Bay Area, finally, there are more testing sites in neglected communities. I mean, it's taken many, many months, but it is now available fairly widely and it is free. And public health officials are saying that if you're out on the streets and you do have symptoms, you should be tested as soon as possible. What is it like in Minneapolis?
In Minneapolis, they have been drive-through sites. I don't know what the status of those sites are right now with everything going on, but they are doing testing. The governor has sort of tried to increase availability of tests, but at the same time, we are seeing an uptake in arrests for people violating curfew and just being out in the protests and getting exposed.
Right. What are your thoughts on this, Professor Nimps? I've been reading a few articles, and black doctors are saying, my family members are out on the streets. I would like to join them, but things are still pretty hectic at various hospitals. We do have to be concerned about COVID. She goes, one of the doctors said, but you cannot ask people to stay home right now because there's just too much at stake.
No, I agree. I, as I've oftentimes said, I'm a 77-year-old African-American male, and I'm a part of that vulnerable group. But I was so outraged at what happened, I felt the need to come out and to protest. There's some things you have to do, and try to be as observant and careful as possible. But there are times you have to come out. As one young person at one of the demonstrations said, yes, the virus can kill us, but also the police are killing us.
Since you have been on the streets for more than four decades, Professor Nimps, can you talk about the changes that you have experienced in the way the police react to these kinds of marches and actions?
Well, the police are not as vicious as they once were. If you go back and look at the 1960s, for example, and look at the number of protesters who were murdered by the police and the National Guard and the U.S. Army in places like Los Angeles, and I think there were maybe 55 people who were killed. But for one city after another, I'm talking about the Watts Rebellion in 1965. But if you look at those protests, the number of people who actually were killed by the police. I'm just asking for putting things in historical perspective. And a part of it is the fact that because these protests have the kind of moral authority that they do, it means that it makes it more difficult. It puts the ruling class a little bit more on the defensive. And this is why it's so important that the protests remain peaceful. My experience has been when we, in 1992, for example, with the Rodney King beating and the protests that came out of that decision by the jury to exculpate the four policemen who beat him. And what we did here was to make sure that our protest was a peaceful demonstration, because we didn't want to give the cops an excuse. This is a problem with anybody who resorts or takes advantage of these protests to try to turn them into violent protests. All they're doing is giving the police an excuse. And they don't need an excuse. They don't need much of an excuse. And so, yes, the importance of peaceful protests is of dire importance.
I asked the question, Professor Nims, because a lot of people are wondering, you know, what explains what seems like changes in police tactics, especially police really going after journalists. I mean, we've seen journalists hit with tear gas and, you know, other, like, I don't know the technical term for it, but it was almost like someone on CNN got hit with like a firework last night, but it was a police weapon. So what are your thoughts about how the police are, it seems like, targeting journalists, really getting in the way, saying, I don't care. When they say I'm media, they're right there.
Yes, that's that is something I can't remember happening before in previous protests. It could mean that they're responding in an extremely indiscriminate kind of way. Whether or not they're actually targeting the press itself, it really doesn't help their cause. When they went after CNN, for example, boy, that didn't look very well. So I'm not sure what it actually represents. I'd have to go back and think about previous protests, whether or not the press were targeted. Is this something new or not?
And Dr. Ahmed, before we let you go, I want to ask you about the piece you wrote in Min Post, For People of Color, Minnesota Nice is Reminiscent of Racism We've Experienced. You wrote this back in December, and you write that the Minnesota transplant proposed an idea in a meeting a couple weeks before you wrote this. Greeted with head nods and smiles, the transplant mistakenly thought that he had consensus, only to find out later that people thought his idea was interesting. That's Minnesotan for not good. They talked about it not just with the transplant. Can you talk about this? Because there have been some coverage of this, what it really means, Minnesota Nice. Who's that for?
Yes, the Minnesota culture, as I've understood it, the Minnesota Nice culture, as I've understood it as a transplant who's been here since 2013, is very conflict averse. It is culturally seems very uncomfortable and an alien idea to express disagreement publicly. When in an environment which is predominantly white, that comes across as reminiscent of racism when you're on the receiving end of this, because in my experiences and in the experience of other people of color, it's like, why won't you just give me the respect of telling me what you mean, or why won't you just tell me that you don't agree with me? And it kind of, you know, you kind of see it playing out in different diversity and inclusion initiatives where there would be a diversity and inclusion department in workplaces headed by maybe a white person, or there would be all this talk about doing something, but not really actual work to change a structure. And oftentimes a lot of these, diversity departments that are built in organizations, they have little power to change anything. It's like kind of giving people a sandbox to play in, but not really kind of also not really wanting to do anything structurally different to address the inequities in Minnesota.
Professor Nims, what has your experience been like?
Yes, I've been here since 1971, after university of Minnesota. And in my department, political science department, we've made a few gains, but just in the last couple of years. Up until the last couple of years, I was the only faculty person, African-American person of color, in the department. We've done a little bit better over the last couple of years, and so yes, this is a problem. I'm not sure it's it's particular to Minnesota. If you look at the entire country, the kinds of progress we were making one time has eroded in many instances. So yes, it's a national problem. And at the same time, if we put it in broad historical perspective, it seems to me it represents important gains. And I think especially in the workplace, and it depends if you're talking about in the more elite and upper class kinds of workplaces, this is where you find the greatest problem. In meatpacking plants, for example, or at the Walmart, in these Amazon centers and so on, I'm struck by the diversity, the international diversity of the workforce. So I think if you're talking about the working class in its basic industry and manufacturing, here you find them extremely diverse, very diverse, very international workforce. But when you start getting into the more elite kinds of job situations, yes, it's a problem.
Right. Dr. Ahmed, before we let you go, we're planning to do weeks of shows around police brutality, but to really talk about other issues like the lack of clean water in many communities, the lack of access mm-hmm. to healthy food in many communities, which contributes. It's all connected, of course. And a lot of people have been asking, like Professor Nimp said, these protests are taking place in so many cities across the country. How do you continue that momentum to ensure that we begin seeing systemic change? How are you thinking about that question?
I think for me, it starts with, and I invite other people to also think about it, this starts with recognizing and acknowledging our complicity in perpetuating this harm. And looking at the different ways that we are part of the oppressive system and we are upholding the oppressive system. I, for example, I'm a physician in Minnesota, and I'm proud of other physicians and healthcare providers who are actually taking care of people in their during this pandemic in when they come to their communities. But I feel that at least in Minnesota, our voices have not, we've been very timid in actually advocating and aligning ourselves with the working class people. There's been a lot of outrage by nurses. There's been a lot of outrage by other healthcare workers, by other worker class people. But the upper class, the physicians and other, higher earning, healthcare providers, have been largely afraid to speak up. That is not the case on the East Coast and also not on the West Coast, but at least in my region, I feel that we are very much within the confines of our professional organizations, which have an incestuous relationship with the forces that keep us oppressed in the States, i.e. The for-profit healthcare system.
Well, Dr. Adnan Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ahmed is a community psychiatrist in Minneapolis who's been at the protests over the last week. He supports Medicare for All and was part of the group Doctors for Bernie. You can read a piece he wrote for MinnPost. For people of color, Minnesota Nice is reminiscent of racism we've experienced. It's at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with August Nimps Jr., professor of political science and African and American studies at the University of Minnesota. He is the author of several books, including his latest, Lenin's Electoral Strategy, The Ballot, The Streets, or Both. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. As I said, we are going to do a number of shows around police brutality and overall injustice. We are going to do a show about Black women who are killed by police and why they don't get more attention. We did talk about Breonna Taylor a couple of weeks ago, but this issue deserves far more attention. We'll also talk about police brutality against Native Americans. We're going to do shows about what it will take to ensure that people have access to clean water and healthy food. These issues are all so connected. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by August Nimps Jr., professor of political science and African and American studies at the University of Minnesota. Professor Nimps is the author of many books, including Lenin's Electoral Strategy, The Ballot, The Streets, or Both. Professor Nimps has been in the streets marching against police brutality for over four decades. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. Why don't we spend some time talking about the protests? Because the media, it seems like, you know, they'll spend some time talking about peaceful protests and interviewing people, and then it switches and it's all about violence and looting. So let's talk about the protests. If you were out on the streets, we'd love to hear from you. What was your experience like? What are you seeing in your community? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Nimps, let's spend some time talking about why it is so important that what we are seeing on the streets is really a multiracial action.
Yes, it's important because that's the only way in which we can bring about real fundamental change. That is, it has to be inclusive because the working class comes in all kinds of skin colors, all kinds of genders, all kinds of national origins. And so the broader the protests are, the more representative they are of the working class. It begins to put in place the basic ingredient for bringing about fundamental change. So that, to me, is encouraging for me. So, again, looking at what happened in the 1960s when the police protests, that is, protests against police brutality, were almost exclusively African-American, that placed limits on what could actually be done in terms of bringing about fundamental change. So yes, that's why it's so important to make them inclusive and to make them peaceful. And to make them peaceful, because if they are not peaceful, that limits the number of people. If it becomes clear that it's going to be a violent action, that limits the number of people who can actually participate.
I was struck by a young woman in Long Beach who was one of the leaders of that protest, and she told CNN, "You all don't give a F about us until we get violent." And I spent some time actually listening to the voices of young people when I could find them, and most young Black people said the same thing. You all don't listen to us until we get violent.
Yes, I know that's the feeling of many people, and but it's a short-sighted. It's a short-sighted opinion. And again, we got to step back and look at the big changes. When do big changes actually take place? Big changes take place when the masses, in their largest numbers, go into the streets. And so, there may be a time when revolutionary moments are violent, but if you look at, I think the big picture, the greater the number of people in the streets, the less violent the action is. The revolutionary process actually has to be. That was the case, for example, in the Cuban Revolution on the January 1st, 1959. It was relatively peaceful. On that particular day, that was the general strike in which the masses came to the street, took over the police station. That's in that, which is crucial. It took over the police stations and began reordering society. The Bolshevik Revolution in October, November 1917 in St. Petersburg, Petrograd, that was relatively peaceful. Maybe only 11 people died in Petrograd. Because exactly, because it was so broad. That is, the masses themselves, civilians and soldiers, particularly soldiers, because you always want to win over the soldiers to the revolutionary process. So, yes, there's no reason we don't want to glorify violence in any kind of way, because violence will always be visited upon the oppressed. Yes, we can get attention and so on, and that's what the news media likes. But just because you get attention doesn't mean you bring about real change.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about bringing about real change. And Professor Nimp, since you've been doing this for more than 40 years out on the streets and teaching, you know what it takes. You've seen it happen. And I just want to read one passage from an op-ed piece by Charles Blow. He writes for the New York Times. He writes, "The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed after the violence against protesters was broadcast on TV. Four little girls were killed in the bombing of Birmingham, Alabama, at a church, and the killing of Medgar Evers in 1963. The Civil Rights Act of 1968, popularly known as the Fair Housing Act, was passed after Martin Luther King was assassinated and rioting swept the country."
Yes, there was indeed a lot of violence in that period, but also too, the 1964 Civil Rights Act too was passed in the aftermath of the March on Washington. There was a mass. We hadn't seen any kind of march like that before in August of 1963. That's what put the heat. That's what really put the heat on Congress and the ruling class. The ruling class were very frightened about that much. They thought it was going to be a violent action. But the organizers of it made sure it was a peaceful action that took place. And that march was done. The reason for that march was to put pressure on Congress, actually to pass a civil rights act of 1964. So yes, I would say on balance, it was the mass peaceful protests. In the 1965 Voting Rights Act, for example, that came out of the events in Selma, Alabama. Also in Harlem, there was a march in support of the protesters in Alabama, in Selma. The violence, what the civil rights movement was very conscious about, was to be very peaceful, if anything, to provoke violence on the part of the oppressors. You wanted the oppressors to act out. And by getting the oppressors to act out, it put the civil rights movement in the best light. They were able to take the moral high ground, and taking the moral high ground is important in winning over the masses in their broadest numbers. And what oftentimes happens, unfortunately, there are many people who become impatient and think that you cannot win over the masses. You write them off. You call them all racists, whatever. And by writing and doing that, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And all you're doing is giving the government an opportunity to clamp down on the political space that exists in order to make the protest as broad as possible.
Today we're joined by University of Minnesota Professor August Nimps Jr., who has been taking part in anti-police brutality actions for more than four decades. Professor Nimps has so much historical knowledge about the power of social movements and how to create systemic change. So if you have any questions for Professor Nimps, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Nimps, we have a question from Bruce, and Bruce writes, "The structural challenge for police reform has to do with laws in place that make it nearly impossible to adjudicate and convict police officers charged with murder. These laws are supported by the court system. How can they be challenged and changed?"
Yes, the question goes to the fundamental problem that we face, and we have to always remind people that the police are fundamentally a class institution. From the very beginning of class society, when class society came into existence 10,000 years ago, ruling elites needed police in order to maintain class inequality. That's the fundamental role of the police, is to enforce to enforce the inequalities built into class society and the legal system itself, the laws. The laws themselves are written for the purpose of maintaining social equality. So it's one thing to have a law, but the law has to be enforced. And that's where the police come in. They enforce the law. And I always tell my students when they come to me wanting letters of recommendation to go to law school, I remind them and tell them if they don't know that you should never confuse the law with justice. You can go to law school for 4 years and never ever take a course on justice. The law is an institution, a structural institution designed to protect the interests of the ruling elite. And it's just not me saying this. The former police chief of Minneapolis, he wrote a book called Police Unbound. Tony Boozer, he was the police chief here in the 1980s. And in his book, he makes that very clear. That's what their role was. So we shouldn't be surprised that here in Minnesota, for example, there's never been a cop who's actually gone to jail for murder. That only happened 2 years ago. And it was a black cop of Somali origin. He had killed a white resident in Minneapolis. He was the first cop ever in the history of Minnesota to actually go to jail. Again, we shouldn't be surprised. Nationally, very, very few cops actually go to jail for killing people. And again, that's built into the system. It's a class institution designed to maintain social inequality.
Professor Nimes, it seems like the conversation is really changing this time around. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about, you know, activists say that police reform is just not working. It is really time to defund the police. And if you look at the headlines, the New York Times, here's one. The police killed George Floyd, redirect their funding elsewhere. The New Republic, a liberal publication. The pandemic is the right time to defund the police. It just goes on and on. Huffington Post, The Nation, The Appeal, defund the police. Professor Nimes, we did a series on police violence back in 2015. I was not reading these kinds of headlines back then.
Yes. No, I think there is the sentiment is there. It's a recognition, indeed, that there's something fundamentally problematic about the police, and this sentiment is an expression of it. And but defunding the police will take a mass movement of massive proportions, and I think it's my argument that it will involve a real revolutionary change. So I understand the sentiment. I always remind people that in his last year, Martin Luther King said on many, many occasions, oftentimes forgotten, thinking about the 1964 and the 1965 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and he had his epiphany, and he realized that there was something fundamental that needed to be done. And he oftentimes would say, for there to be racial equality in the United States, there must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Mm-hmm. A radical redistribution of economic and political power. It was a recognition on his part that something fundamental had to be done. And so defunding the police has to be seen as part of something larger, something that King was hinting at, alluding to. Whether or not he fully understood the implications or the revolutionary implications of what he was saying, we'll never know, unfortunately. But yes, I understand where the sentiment is coming from. But for that to actually happen, it will require something of major revolutionary proportions.
It also requires people to get really active at the state and local levels. Right.
Yes, I agree. And but oftentimes you will hear people say that the most important thing we can do is to vote. And I beg to differ. I beg to differ. And if you think about it, if that's true, then how did someone like me, who couldn't vote, get the right to vote. That was the case. The first time I tried to vote in 1964, I was denied because of my skin color. 4 years later, I could. So what happened between those 4 years is because we were in the streets. We were in the streets. And I've seen many people who believe that if you go into the suites, in fact, they were the slogan coming out of the civil rights movement, people would oftentimes say, whatever happened to the civil rights movement? And someone came up with the quip, out of the streets into the suites. Out of the streets into the suites. That's where it went. And because of that, the gains that had been made because of the street actions, they began to erode. And that's the case we have right now in Minnesota. This is going to be very interesting, this investigation on the part of the governor. He just appointed the attorney general to head up the investigation of the four cops. And the person he selected is Keith Ellison. And I collaborated with Keith in police brutality work in the 1980s and the 1990s. He was a key leader in the protests we had in 1992, protesting what had happened to Rodney King. And so in 1992, he was leading the masses in the streets. With disappointment, he's being asked by the governor basically to make sure that the masses do not go back out into the streets when the ruling comes. So it's going to be interesting. And he and I often have many, many debates on this question. He thought the most important thing he could do would be to go inside the system, become a part of the system. He could bring about change by going inside the system. Okay, he'll get a chance now to test his perspective. I have my doubts. I wish him the best for the sake of justice. For the family of George Floyd, you certainly want justice and so on, but I'm not holding my breath that there will be a ruling that will come out of this that will actually be a just ruling.
Keith Ellison said he plans to charge the four officers involved to the highest degree of accountability that the law and the facts will support.
Yes, and we'll see if that's the case. And again, history. If history serves us as any indicator, the probability of the police going to jail, I think, is minimal. What it would take is, again, some kind of real mass actions. And I'm convinced that the governor has appointed him to head this investigation up, is to make sure that people trust the ruling, the eventual ruling that's made, and I think he's in a very, very difficult position.
Professor Nemps, when you talked about not being able to vote because of the color of your skin, and you all just took to the streets to continue fighting. We're seeing people take to the streets night after night, in some cases 6-7 nights, knowing that they could be tear gassed, hit with rubber bullets. What at that time, what kept you going?
Well, the goal, because as I said, keep your eyes on the prize. Yeah, we knew that this was not an easy road to walk. Because we had the historical reality, we could point to victories because they had victories from the past. This is what one of the things that encouraged us. We were heartened by victories elsewhere in the world. The African and Third World Liberation Movement was of particular importance and encouragement. The fight for independence in the Third World and elsewhere, those battles were of enormous importance. So yes, people begin to recognize that this is not an easy process. And that's why it's so important for people to have a sense of history. And oftentimes I run into a lot of young people who don't have a sense of history, and oftentimes we'll get frustrated. And that's why it's so important to look at when we do make gains, to understand how we've made those gains.
Let's take a few callers before we have to end. Let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, thanks. I agree we need to defund the police, but I think in the meantime, we need to be able to be looking at these pro-lynching laws that are on the books locally, state, and federally. I mean, I think the protesters need to be aware of the laws that are actually allowing the police and encouraging the police to do these murders. Locally, we have laws that are contracts that local officials are making with the unions, the police unions, that are protecting them from prosecution. Statewide, we have excessive force laws that are based on a subjective standard of what a so-called reasonable police officer would feel as in fear of his life. And then federally, we have qualified immunity laws, which the Supreme Court has been whittling away so that in the last 15 years, even federal appeals courts have been overturned when they've been granting qualified immunity to cases against police. And there's lawyers have hundreds of people coming to them with cases that they don't even take because they realize that the Supreme Court has so narrowed the exception to qualified immunity that it's almost impossible to win a case. So even if Keith Ellison wants to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law is set up to allow lynching, basically. And I think we need to be aware of this so that we can point the finger at the legislators, at the council people who are supporting and enacting these laws. And that's where we need to start focusing now, because I think that, yes, we need a revolution, and I'm all for that, but I think the protesters need to have some demands that they can put out that people can wrap their minds around.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lisa. Just a quick statistic to Lisa's point, and we're going to spend more time on this tomorrow. According to Mapping Police Violence, from 2013 to 2019, 99% of killings by police did not result in officers being charged. 99%. Professor Nimes, what's your response to Lisa?
Yes. No, she's absolutely right about the legal system. And again, that it goes to the point I was trying to make, that this the legal system exists to defend the class inequalities that exist within society. That's the purpose of the legal system. We shouldn't have any surprises at all about that. And that's why I say exactly we'll take something of fundamental importance to be able to shake that up. Just like there was a Supreme Court ruling we should never forget in 1857 that claimed that African Americans were never supposed to be citizens of the United States. That ruling, the notorious Dred Scott decision, was overturned because of what took place on the battlefield. Within 6 years, that ruling was overturned. And I realize what I'm referring to and talking about may seem very, very difficult, but let's think about what we're up against. What we're up against.
To Lisa's point about demands, Professor Nimes, we're going to be talking about this in the coming weeks. Black Lives Matter has demands. What are your thoughts about what we're seeing out on the streets right now in terms of, you know, the importance of coming up with a list of demands, especially as this election, presidential election, is less than 6 months away?
I think the most important immediate demands, is calling for jailing the cops. Until cops start going to jail, there's no incentive for them to act any differently. The statistic you just gave, 99% of the cases, they don't go to jail. That's the problem. And until that should be the most central demand, the most immediate demand that we make, that the cops have to go to jail. See, the cities keep settling with the families of the victims, what I call blood money. That is, they're willing to give money to the relatives of the victims. That's the way. So they're not willing to reel in the cops. And until the cops start going to jail, and it's a simple demand. Because you start listing all of these demands, and it gets confusing. But jail the cops. That should be the central demand.
Well, thank you for calling, Lisa, and we're going to talk more about this issue extensively. In fact, The Guardian reports that the Minneapolis Public School District is going to vote, actually the Public School Board is voting tonight on a resolution that would terminate the school district's contract with the police department to provide school resource officers, in quotes, and mandate that the superintendent prepare an alternative plan to keep students safe. So we will be tracking this vote tonight, and then we will talk about it on tomorrow's show. Final thoughts, Professor Nimes, just given your long history, marching, studying social movements, and what it really takes to create systemic change.
Again,
what do you expect?
Yeah, I think this is a historic moment we're going through because of the breadth of the protests and the demonstrations. And this is why it's so important for organizers, those who are organizing them, to organize them in a way that they are peaceful. When we had our protests here in 1992 around the Rodney King events, we made sure, we went out of our way, we marshaled ourselves to make sure it was peaceful, because we know there would be agent provocateurs who wanted to turn the march into something that would give the police and the state an excuse to limit political space. So my advice for anybody who's organizing these marches, go to them, be a part of the organizing of them to make sure that they are done in a peaceful way. The more if they are peaceful, you'll bring out more people. And what these demonstrations around the country demonstrate, people are willing to come out. That to me is very encouraging.
August Mintz Jr. is professor of political science and African and American studies at the University of Minnesota. He is the author of several books, including Lenin's Electoral Strategy, The Ballot, The Streets, or Both. Professor Nimes has been in the streets for more than four decades protesting against police brutality. Professor Nimes, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back, and thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, I hope you can join us. We're going to continue our series on the uprisings over the death of George Floyd and police brutality by talking about the changes that activists say are needed. They say police reform is just not working. They say it is time to defund the police. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.